Well, we do have a fine crowd here this morning, and I'm so thankful for your presence and thankful for this opportunity to speak and for us to study together and to listen to these other two good friends of mine who I've known for many years. I'm always particularly glad to have Bob on the same program with me because then I can be the youth minister. I will be quite respectful of our time limits this morning. After having taught for about 55 years, I'm pretty good at observing the bell when we come to the end. So I will warn you that I've got a lot more slides here than I can possibly cover. So what I will do at some points is I will probably flash through some of them quite quickly, which is, I know, annoying. But there are some that I want us to look at in particular. Among the topics that Brother Rod assigned was a topic on the social gospel. It brought back memories to me. First time I ever remember speaking on this subject was in 1960 on the Florida College lectures, and I know Bob was there. So I went and tried to find a copy of my lecture that I'd given in 1960, and I couldn't find one. So we're going to be starting from scratch. And I'm going to talk a bit historically about the social gospel movement, which really was kind of three reactions of American churches in the period from 1870 to about 1920. And the clash that it presented in American Protestantism when these new ideas came along. Now, part of my problem about talking about this, I'm going to be very much in a teaching mode here this morning, is, you know, I've written a lot about this. These two books on the American Restoration Movement, the first called Quest for a Christian America, 1800-1865, and a second book called The Sources of Division in the Disciples of Christ, 1865-1900. I have three chapters in this book on the social gospel. And so it is a little hard to condense that and the significance of that. But when I gave that lecture at Florida College in 1960, I was in the midst of writing these. I was still a graduate student. And wrote these two volumes, which are called A Social History of the Disciples of Christ. And what that implied was that these new social ideas about how churches ought to behave had an impact on the Restoration Movement, or those who were seeking to go back and just be primitive New Testament Christians. And so I will look with you for just a few minutes this morning about the implications of this movement and how it impacted those who had set out to say, what we want to do is just be primitive New Testament Christians. That is an idea that I also have done a lot of study of, and that is the idea of going back and just being the primitive church. And I'll just introduce that concept to say that's what the social gospel does. It challenges this old idea that what Christians need to do is go back and just be like New Testament churches. And, of course, that's the lesson that I want us to get out at the end of this session this morning. This is an idea that has been widely studied by American church historians. I participated in a couple of high-level academic conferences on the American Quest for the Primitive Church, the first one in 1986, I believe, that was published in 1988 by the University of Illinois Press. It was interesting. There were scholars present at these conferences presenting papers from really just about every major university in the country, because all of them have programs in American religious history, and all of them are quite conscious that the root of American religious thinking is in this idea of going back and being a primitive church. That's what I said in my closing address. Is one indelible impression I take away from this conference is that the Restoration ideal has been a powerful motif. In fact, it may be the most vital single assumption underlying the development of American Protestantism. Equally important, the Restoration ideal continues as one of the most compelling ideas in modern Christianity. All over the world, millions of Christians still seek a restoration of the church's lost purity. So now that's the setting for American churches when the social gospel movement comes along after the Civil War. They almost all, this was the second of those conferences, the primitive church in the modern world, and the scholars at that conference, it was interesting how they traced this idea that it was in all American denominations, whether it's Presbyterians or Methodists or Baptists, that they all had this concept that what churches ought to be is they just ought to be the kind of spiritual institutions that you find in the New Testament. So that concept is around. It also has been around throughout Christian history, and wish we had time to pursue that. But American religion up until the 1870s was pretty largely based on this Puritan base that had been formed around this concept that what we need to do is go back and just be the primitive church, as this English Puritan leader and martyr, John Hooper, said, nothing should be used in the church which has not either the express word of God to support it or otherwise is a thing indifferent in itself. And so this idea that what churches were is churches were just institutions that were supposed to do the things that New Testament churches had done. That's my list, by the way, which we'll come back to at the end of the session. If you want to find out what a New Testament church was, actually the only way I know to do that is to read the New Testament. Every time you read something about one, you just make a note of that, and when you get done, you draw a line and add that up, and that's what we know about what a New Testament church was. That's not a unique idea with me. Actually, I can find people for hundreds of years back into history who had lists that looked just like mine. That's the dominant approach to church authority since the Reformation, at least, and probably before. Based on this assumption that what God intended was for churches to be ordered according to the rules that the apostles laid down. And if we had time for that lesson, but I got to go to the social gospel here. But that's a principle that is stated many times in the New Testament, that the apostles set in order what churches were to be. These two passages in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus, the first chapter, quite familiar to us. Both of them come after instructions have been given about the appointment of elders and deacons in local churches. And you remember that 1 Timothy 3:15, which we quote many times, but if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of truth. So he said, I gave these directions, not because it's just something I thought might work, but that it is God's instructions about the order that New Testament churches are to take. Now, the American Restoration Movement, if we were going to do that lesson, is a story of people who set out with that aim and then who spread out and disagree about whether one can follow that aim. And the reason for that, I tell you, an interesting just historical observation about why people change their mind about what churches ought to be like, or they change their mind actually what nations ought to be like and what businesses ought to be like. They change their mind about everything. And so lots of times people will say, well, why is it that then you have this rather singular basis of authority of going back and just being primitive New Testament Christian? And then a little ways down the line, people spread out and they have different ideas about what churches ought to be and what other things ought to be. And the question always is, well, what happens to these people? And I tell you what happens is those people die. That's what happens. And then 50 years later, what you have different people. And different people do different things. They have different ideas. And when people say, what's happened to this country? We're just not like we used to be. What happened to this country? It's a different country. It's different people. And consequently, what happens is, through the centuries, people change because you have different people. Now, the way people change, by and large, is they look around them and see what's going on. We are always influenced by what is going on around us. And if we had time to preach that sermon, that's my Judges 2 sermon, when the Jews go in and take possession of the Promised Land. And they served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. And then another generation came along which knew not the Lord nor all the mighty works that He had done for Israel. And they did evil in the sight of the Lord. And interesting, what they did is they forsook Jehovah, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed the gods of the people who were round about them and bowed themselves to them and provoke the Lord to anger. So what happens is the time comes when people stop looking inside for authority. That's what primitive Christianity is. And start looking outside for authority. And for all of those who are preachers in the audience, I would just exhort you to recognize that the basis of who we are, the basis of who I am, is that I want to go back and just follow God's authority. And the way you find that is you find that in the Scriptures. And you can read as many books as you want to, written by evangelical scholars that you think are smart. And most of them, I know, and they're not so smart. But what we need to do is never get enamored by what's going on all around us. That's not where authority comes from if we set out to just be primitive Christians. All right, now the social gospel. Here's my three chapters. There were basically, after the Civil War, three responses to the social problems in the country. And these three responses were, how do we solve the problems of the nation? Or how do churches solve the social problems of the nation? One of them is a strongly leftist movement that says churches should become involved in political action. A second is an embrace of social institutions as the primary response of the church, and the churches had a fundamental responsibility for funding, supporting, and organizing social institutions. Whereas other people continue to insist that the mission of the church is spiritual, and that its New Testament description is not a social gospel, but rather a spiritual gospel designed for the salvation of those who are part of the kingdom of God. Now, here, I'm going to skip through some slides. The classic social gospel was an ecumenical movement that banded American churches together in 1905, 33 denominations, the largest denominations in the country, banded together as essentially political social reform institutions. A World Council of Churches is founded in 1948. The Federal Council of Churches changes its name to the National Council of Churches in America in 1950. These bodies, by and large, assumed that the responsibility of churches was to build a perfect society. And they were post-millennialists, but that's not an idea that we have time to chase down this morning. The most famous theologian of the social gospel was a Baptist preacher named Walter Rauschenbusch, who lived in Rochester, New York. Wrote a very influential book called Christianity and the Social Crisis, and published in 1907. And he was a socialist. And what he said is that it is the primary responsibility of the church to reform society, and capitalism will never be reformable. It's just greedy. And so, consequently, what we need to do is establish a socialist or communist social order. Now, that's the left wing of the social gospel, which was very influential. It was influential in these new organizations that were founded, in the Federal Council of Churches of Christ and the World Council of Churches of Christ, who had what we would call today very politically correct concepts of what churches ought to be. Is they ought to be the enforcers of and the instigators of social justice. They wrote a social creed in 1908, which said, to us it seems that the churches must stand for equal rights and complete justice for all men in all stations of life. Now, there are a number of variations of that. There's been a later social creed published in 2007. That just says that the mission of the church is to generate social justice and to address the great questions of our day of poverty and the rights of all classes and global warming and whatever. And that has been assigned for social gospelers as the mission of the church. They frequently appeal to Old Testament prophets and their calls for justice, which are, of course, calls that still address God's nation of Israel, which is His people. Well, all right, so much for that. There's a second version of the social gospel that was put forth by more conservative scholars and preachers, who embraced this idea that the church was founded with a fundamental social mission, and that consequently what was needed was for churches to build institutions and organizations for social causes to help the poor. Now, and a lot of organizations, benevolent and social organizations, date from this period, including YMCA, WCA, and various rescue missions, Salvation Army. That really changed the nature and the look of American churches after the Civil War. It introduced the concept, which was called then the institutional church. That is, that a church ought to be the supporter of institutions, the builder of institutions, and to be an institution itself. Now, it's interesting, these two pictures are. This top picture is the first Puritan meeting house. And Up until 1860, any church building that you find historically, architecturally, was just a meeting house, because that's what churches did. And the idea of the church becoming a social service center really comes out of this movement, out of the social gospel movement. So that at the bottom, we get the emergence of churches that establish schools for immigrants and created medical dispensaries and food distribution centers and all kind of other social service institutions. And many of them viewed this as that this is the way that God had determined that He would save people. That you had to be a social service center in order to attract people and to save them. So you have these movements and the establishment of institutions, which are not inherently wrong in their own right, but if one is defining what is the mission of the church, that's a new way to define what the mission of the church is. Orphanages were particularly prolific in that being founded during these years. I'm going to skip this file. Orphanages were always debated whether that was a good idea or not, for churches to support orphanages. Same is true of colleges. By groups that originate out of this American primitive movement, the Disciples of Christ, Churches of Christ, there are 40 Churches of Christ orphanages in existence today, 32 educational institutions. But now, I want to talk with you about there's discussion of all of this. And many people within primitive churches who said what we've done is set out just to be primitive Christians, questioned, well, the leftist vision of the social gospel never penetrated very far into the movement, though it did somewhat, if we had time to discuss that. But the whole issue of is it the church's fundamental responsibility the establishment of an equitable society and helping the poor and so on. And what I would like for us just to quickly glance at is the kind of the line of thinking that leads me to be here this morning, believing in a spiritual church, is what was the issue raised by these new approaches to church action? And I want to say that there are a number of things that were not at stake. One is not whether Christians are good citizens. I mean, it is, the scriptures are quite clear that we all agree that we should be good citizens. And by the way, I'm all for trying to make this as good a country as you can make it. It still won't be very good, actually. You will live in the midst of corruption and our inability to make a perfect society. But I have no problem with Christians saying what we need to do is we need to be good citizens. That's what the scriptures tell us as well. But I'll not tarry to look at all these passages. And what all of us do need to remember is that we are citizens of a grander kingdom. And our citizenship is in heaven. And Jesus quite clearly said that His kingdom was not of this world. So His mission was not to come and create a perfect society, which there has not so far been. And I will stake my credentials as a prophet to tell you that there will not be in the future as well. Another non-issue is whether Christians should be compassionate and generous toward all men. I don't know anybody ever disagreed about that. That is obviously quite true. Galatians 6:10, the most quoted scriptural elaboration of that. As we therefore have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are the household of faith. So there's no question that all Christians are committed to the idea that we should be compassionate. Actually, the issue that the social gospel raised was never, are orphan homes and other Christian institutions good works? They often are, I think. The orphan homes are very old in Christian history. They're ever present. And no one is, as far as I know, questioned the right of such institutions to exist. Now, if you looked up orphan homes in Wikipedia, which I don't recommend, I dislike Wikipedia a lot. But anyhow, occasionally it is easier to quote it than something else. And it notes that there's a very strong movement regarding orphanages in the 20th century that's called deinstitutionalization, in which, as it says, during the 20th century, conventional wisdom held that orphanages were the worst possible care option for children. I'm not sure I think that's true. Now, overseas, I will tell you what, you do have to be very careful, because they're the basis of much fraud that is perpetrated by people in other countries just to get American money. But in America, the polls show that almost everybody in America who has come through an orphanage has found it to be a positive experience. So it's not a question of whether orphan homes are good institutions or not. It's just like schools that are operated by Christians. These two men spent a whole lot of their life teaching in a school in a environment where people were Christians. I've always missed that, teaching in state universities, and have thought I have loved to have taught those students. There are a lot of good things about it. But you have Christian men who are teaching you. You have students who have similar convictions, and you might even be able to get a husband or a wife. So that's not the issue. The issue is, who funds it? And is that the responsibility of churches? By the way, I showed this at home the other day, so you might want to come to the lecture sometime. They're uplifting, particularly this year. If you come, be sure you get there on Monday night. All right. Now here, quickly. This is the issue raised by the institutional social gospel. Is, what did New Testament churches do? And the practice of New Testament churches was that they took care of needy saints within that family. There are 9 passages in the New Testament that talk about the social responsibilities of New Testament churches. If we had time, we'd look at all of those. But the point in each one of them is that the social responsibility taken on by local congregations was the support of believers, disciples, brethren, poor saints. And that uniformly, if you look at what New Testament churches did, is they supported needy saints. They didn't establish institutions. And so, I return to my list. If you're a primitivist, you say, what I want to do is I just want to do what New Testament churches did. And A lot of you have seen my little demonstration of this with singing. You know, we sing. We sing without instrumental music. And we do that because I can find passages where Christians did that. And by the way, the early post-New Testament data is uniform in that practice. But you can ask the question, should we really make a fuss about that? About whether you sing with or without instrumental music. It seems pretty trivial and minor to me. It does to me too. Although, that's a pretty modern sentiment. You know, if you went back to the 19th century, when most of these people were biblical primitivists, that was a very real matter of discussion. And most people thought that you should sing without instrumental music. The Greek Orthodox Church, still in many of its versions, does not use instrumental music. And as one of their bishops said, in Eastern Europe, the music performed by the Eastern Orthodox cathedrals and monasteries is exclusively sung without music. Bishop Callistos Ware says, the service is sung even though there may be no choir. In the Orthodox Church today, as in the early church, singing is accompanied, unaccompanied, and instrumental music is not found. So, the question of whether you use instrumental music seems minor. But it wasn't minor to people who believed the Scriptures in the 19th century and in the 20th century. This is a quote from John Calvin, which I've always liked. Musical instruments in the celebration, celebrating the praises of God, would be no more suitable than the burning of incense, the lighting of lamps, and the restoration of the shadows of the law. Now, why would the founder of Presbyterianism make a statement like that? And the answer is, because in the Westminster Confession of Faith in 1636, the proposition concerning the Scriptures is the whole counsel of God concerning all things necessary for His own glory, man's salvation, and faith and life is either expressly set down in Scripture or by good necessary consequence may be deduced from Scripture, under which nothing at any time is to be added, whether by new revelations of Spirit or traditions of men. Now, if that's what you believe about the Scriptures, then that's what you believe about singing. And so, Wesley's comment is also classic. I have no objection to instruments of music in our chapels, provided they're neither heard nor seen. So, that issue seems trivial. But, that issue is fundamental. That issue of whether I'm going to be a primitive New Testament Christian determines what I do when I worship. I do what I can read New Testament churches doing. When I read my 9 passages of what New Testament churches did in terms of social relief, there are all kind of extraneous roads that one can run down. But the question is, does that really matter? Is that important? Seems pretty narrow-minded to me. But that's the issue I'm not willing to give up. If you want to be a primitive New Testament Christian, then you are bound to do what was done by the ordering of the churches by apostolic authority in the New Testament. Is that it? Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Say an interesting little anecdote to close our lesson. In 2002, at the meeting of American Academy of Religion, which is the big meeting of religion scholars, they did a session about me and my writings. And one of the papers was read by a good friend of mine, Sam Hill, who was chairman of the Department of Religion at the University of Florida at the time. And Sam and I had known each other for a long time, had many religious discussions. And So he told some anecdotes. And one of them was, he said, a second incident took place during a breakfast conversation at an annual meeting of the Southern Historical Association about 1982. I pulled out the old chestnut. Let's compress our respective philosophies of life to one word. I said, meaning. Whatever in Sam Hill that means. If you knew Sam Hill, you'd know a little more about what it means. He said, obedience. You've just learned something about the speaker and the one whose work is being spoken about. I throw this out. Ed Harrell, Ed, the self-characterized religious legalist and eminent scholar, D.E.H. Jr., are the same person. That's a compliment, and it assists our understanding of his regarding objectivity as something obtaining near fetish proportions. That's true. That's the way I've tried to write history. Getting it right is important. Telling it, like it, the facts reveal, is what you should do. And getting apostolic authority right is important. We don't do what we do because that's what the latest fad is in religion. And because somebody has thought, well, what we need to do is we need to behave ourselves in a different way. We do it because we believe in following apostolic authority. And the gospel that we need to follow is not the social gospel, not a social gospel, but it is the gospel that we can find in the scriptures. And the answer is, to what we should be doing is, that is it. I'll tell you one other quick story that many of you have heard me tell before. About a friend of mine at the University of Arkansas when I was teaching out in Arkansas. And I befriended, I was a kind of a very senior scholar. And I befriended one of the young men who just come to teach. And by the way, people ask me a lot of times, have you ever had trouble in your academic work with people trying to put you down? And the answer to that is probably in my early years a little bit. But by the time I was at Arkansas, I was chairman of the Committee on Raises and Promotions, so I didn't have any trouble at all. But anyhow, this young man, he was an Englishman. He had his PhD from Cambridge. And he was a kind of a typical working class socialist atheist. And it was a kind of a strange friendship that we developed. But we developed it because we played golf together. So anyhow, one day we were playing golf. And he said to me, he said, I'll say, Ed, someone told me you were a Christian. I said, well, yeah, I'm a Christian. He said, that's odd. He said, I never met an intellectual before that was a Christian. And I said, well, you probably still haven't. But I said, I want to tell you what kind of Christian I am. I said, I don't have any defense for most of what goes on in the name of Christian. And I'll tell you what, a lot of historians are anti-Christian. And they're anti-Christian because so much sorriness has been done in the name of Christian. And I said, I don't defend most ideas that are floated as Christian out here. I said, I'm just believing, going back and reading what the earliest Christians did. And doing that, not doing anything else. And he didn't say anything. So we played about three or four holes. And finally he turned to me and said, "Well, I must say, if one must be a Christian, that would be a good kind to be." That's the kind to be. I will tell you what makes it awfully easy to defend yourself. To not say I got a new idea, but I got an old idea. I've got one that I can find in the Scripture. That's all I have to defend. So the social gospel was just one of those new ways, new ideas about how we need to remodel the church. Do something different. It had its day, faded. There are other new ideas that come along. These brethren are going to be speaking to some of them. All right. Time for the bell. Brother Rod.